A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching that PBS Frontline documentary from late March, Strike on Iran, The Nuclear Question, and it got him thinking about the gap between managed access and actual access. What would happen if a Western journalist already inside Iran with some kind of press credentials decided to just drive toward a sensitive site like the Isfahan Uranium Conversion Facility? And he wants us to cross-reference with Israel's Negev Nuclear Research Center near Dimona. Same question, different security philosophy. Let's run the thought experiment.
This is exactly the kind of thing I love digging into, because the public understanding of how these security perimeters actually work is almost completely wrong. Most people imagine a fence with some guards. The reality is a multi-layered surveillance gradient that starts the moment you enter the country and escalates in predictable, measurable thresholds.
The PBS documentary is the perfect jumping-off point because it creates this illusion. They got inside Iran, they got footage, they talked to officials. Surely if you can do that, you could drive a little further down the road and snap some photos of the centrifuges.
Which is exactly the misconception we need to dismantle. Let's define our two sites first. Isfahan Uranium Conversion Facility, about 10 kilometers southeast of Isfahan city center, coordinates roughly 32.66 north, 51.68 east. It's surrounded by desert, it's inside an IRGC-controlled exclusion zone, and it's where Iran converts yellowcake into uranium hexafluoride gas. That's the feedstock for centrifuges. The facility is not hidden. You can see it on Google Earth, but getting near it is an entirely different proposition.
The Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona facility, coordinates roughly 31 north, 35.14 east, operational since 1964. Israel's undeclared nuclear weapons facility, and one of the most heavily guarded sites on Earth. The security philosophy there is fundamentally different from Iran's, and that's what makes the comparison interesting.
Iran's approach is layered and reactive. They want plausible deniability until you cross a clear red line. They prefer to catch you, detain you, expel you, and use the diplomatic leverage. Israel's approach is preemptive and aggressive. They will intercept you before you even reach the outer perimeter, with less warning and harsher consequences. Military court, not civilian.
Let's establish the baseline surveillance before our hypothetical journalist even leaves the hotel. In Iran, any Westerner entering on a journalist visa is flagged immediately by the Ministry of Intelligence and IRGC Intelligence. Your passport is scanned at Imam Khomeini Airport. Your visa application has already been reviewed by multiple agencies, and by the time you check into your hotel, you have a file.
It's not just passive paperwork. Iran's MOIS operates at least 12 known Stingray IMS eye catchers across major highways, per procurement documents leaked in 2024. An IMS eye catcher is essentially a fake cell tower. Your phone connects to it and it extracts your international mobile subscriber identity, your location, your call metadata. If you're a flagged Western journalist, your phone's IMS eye is already in the system. The moment it pings a Stingray on the highway heading southeast from Isfahan City, someone in a monitoring station knows.
Your rental car is also tagged. Iran's traffic camera network uses automatic number plate recognition linked to IRGC databases. The plates on your rental were logged when you picked it up, and if you booked it through a travel agency, which you almost certainly did to get your visa, the agency shared that information. The car is a tracking device, even if you leave your phone behind.
In Israel, the Shin Bet's regional surveillance network operates on similar principles, but with different technology. Highway checkpoints in the Negev use facial recognition. Your face is matched against a watch list of journalists, activists, and persons of interest. If you're a foreign journalist who's been in the country for a few days, your face has already been captured at Ben Gurion Airport, at your hotel lobby, at highway cameras. The system knows who you are before you even point your rental car south.
There's a documented case from 2018. An Israeli Arab journalist drove within 2 kilometers of Dimona before being intercepted. Shin Bet had installed a tracking device on his car during what appeared to be a routine traffic stop the day before. He had no idea he was tagged.
That's the baseline. You're under surveillance before you leave your hotel. Now let's talk about what happens as you actually start moving toward the site. I want to break this down by distance because the escalation isn't random. It follows a predictable ladder.
Let's do it. Phase 1. Passive surveillance, roughly 50 to 20 kilometers from the site. What does that look like in Iran?
You're driving southeast on the highway out of Isfahan City. At this distance, Iran's MOIS is primarily interested in confirming that you're actually heading toward the exclusion zone and not just sightseeing. Your phone's IMSI is being logged by Stingray devices at major intersections. The traffic cameras with ANPR are logging your plate. If you rented a GPS unit with the car, and most rentals in Iran come with one, that GPS is reporting your position. The IRGC's Provincial Command Center is receiving all of this passively. Nobody's been dispatched yet. This is just data collection.
In Israel at this distance?
Shin Bet's approach at 20 to 50 kilometers is already more active. In the Negev, there are fewer major highways, so your route is more predictable. If you're heading south on Route 40 or Route 25 toward Dimona, you're going to pass through checkpoints where facial recognition is running. But here's the key difference. Israel's security posture assumes hostile intent earlier. A foreign journalist heading toward Dimona without a prearranged IDF escort will trigger a flag within minutes, not hours. The Shin Bet regional desk will alert the IDF Southern Command, and a decision is made immediately about whether to intercept.
Iran watches and waits. Israel watches and moves. That's the philosophical split in a nutshell.
Now, phase 2, active monitoring, roughly 20 to 5 kilometers from the site. This is where things get physical.
In Iran, you're now on secondary roads. The highway has given way to smaller routes that serve the villages and industrial zones southeast of Isfahan. At this distance, the IRGC deploys drone surveillance. We're talking about Shahed 129 or Mohajir 6 drones loitering overhead, feeding real-time video to the provincial IRGC command center. These drones can stay airborne for 12 to 24 hours, and they're equipped with electro-optical sensors that can read your license plate from several kilometers away. You might not see the drone. It could be at 3,000 meters, but it sees you.
On the ground, the traffic police you encounter at this distance are not actually traffic police. They're besieged militia with radios. The besieged are the IRGC's civilian auxiliary. They're everywhere in Iran, and they act as human sensors. A besieged member at a roadside checkpoint might wave you through, but he's already radioed your description and direction to the next checkpoint. You've been identified, confirmed, and passed along the chain.
Israel's version of Phase 2 is more direct. If you're within 20 kilometers of Dimona, a police patrol is likely to pull you over. But these aren't regular police. They're Shin Bet or IDF military intelligence officers in civilian vehicles or marked patrol cars. They'll ask where you're going, they'll run your documents through a secure terminal in the vehicle, and they'll ask questions designed to assess whether you're lost, curious, or hostile. If you claim you're a tourist who made a wrong turn, they'll escort you back to the main road. If you're a journalist who admits you're trying to get close to Dimona, you're going to be detained. There's something darkly funny about the wrong turn defense in both contexts. In Iran, they know exactly where you've been for the last 3 days. In Israel, they've been tracking you since you left Tel Aviv. I'm lost. It's not a plausible claim when your entire route has been logged.
Which brings us to phase 3, interdiction, roughly 5 to 1 kilometer from the site. This is the point of no return.
In Iran, the outer security perimeter around Isfahan UCF is marked by unmarked concrete barriers and no photography signs in Farsi. There's no fence at this distance. The barriers are designed to channel vehicles into choke points where they can be stopped. If you drive past these barriers, the response is immediate. A Quds Force Rapid Reaction Team in civilian SUVs will box your vehicle in. They prefer capture. Shooting a Western journalist creates a diplomatic incident that Iran doesn't want. They'll surround you, order you out, and take you into custody.
The 2022 case is instructive here. A French journalist was detained about 8 kilometers from Isfahan UCF, so right at the edge of what we're calling Phase 3. She'd been tracked for 3 days prior per the phone data that was later extracted. She was held for 72 hours at an IRGC facility in Kashan, about 100 kilometers north, before being expelled. Her footage was confiscated, her notes were reviewed, and she was put on a plane. The message was clear: we knew you were coming, we let you get close enough to scare you, and now you're leaving.
72 hours in an IRGC facility is not a slap on the wrist. That's a deliberate psychological operation.
Now, Israel's outer perimeter at Dimona is more visible and more aggressive. At 5 kilometers, you'll encounter razor wire and motion sensors. The terrain around Dimona is arid and open. There's no cover, no villages, no plausible reason to be there. A border police unit will deploy spike strips and order you out at gunpoint. If you don't comply immediately, the escalation is rapid.
Then Phase 4, lethal force inside 1 kilometer. This is the inner ring.
Iran's inner ring around Isfahan is defended by IRGC Aerospace Force with anti-aircraft positions. We're talking Skyguard air defense systems and 358 surface-to-air missiles. These are positioned to defend against aerial threats, but they can engage ground targets if necessary. If a vehicle doesn't stop after warning shots, the IRGC will fire. They're not going to let an unidentified vehicle reach the facility perimeter.
Israel's inner ring at Dimona uses Rafael's Sentry Tech automated machine gun turrets, which incorporate the Iron Fist detection system with a 2 kilometer engagement range. The policy is no warning for vehicles breaching the fence. If you crash the outer barrier and keep driving, the turrets will fire. There's no negotiation at this distance. The system is automated. Human decision-making has been removed from the loop because response time is measured in seconds.
This is where the comparison between the two sites really crystallizes. Iran will try to capture you. Israel will shoot you. Both outcomes are catastrophic for the hypothetical journalist, but the threshold for lethal force is different. Iran wants the diplomatic leverage of a detained Westerner. Israel wants the deterrent effect of a dead one.
That's a grim way to put it, but it's accurate. Now let's talk about the knock-on effect, because even if you don't get shot or detained, your little road trip has consequences that most people don't consider.
This is the part I find most interesting. Even if you're intercepted at Phase 2 or Phase 3 and released, your presence has triggered a security review. At Isfahan, the facility may temporarily halt operations. Enrichment cascades might be shifted to backup centrifuges in underground halls. Deception measures activate. Dummy buildings, mobile launchers repositioned, equipment moved or covered. The 2023 IIIEI inspector reports documented this. During unannounced visits to Isfahan, certain equipment had been moved or concealed within 90 minutes of their arrival. That's a rapid response concealment protocol that kicks in the moment an unexpected visitor is detected.
That's fast. And that protocol isn't just for IIEI inspectors. It's for any unexpected approach. Your journalistic curiosity has just disrupted operations at a nuclear facility.
Your journalism becomes a SIGINT opportunity for Iranian intelligence. They're going to monitor who you call after you're released, what you photograph, whether you deviate from your declared itinerary in the following days. Your phone is now a collection platform for them. Every call you make, every message you send, every photo you take for the rest of your trip is being analyzed to determine if you're working with an intelligence agency.
The 2022 French journalist, her phone data showed she'd been tracked for 3 days before detention. But what's less reported is that her phone continued to be monitored for the remaining duration of her stay in Iran after her release. She was a walking collection opportunity.
In Israel, the knock-on effect are different but equally significant. If you're intercepted near Dimona, you're going to be questioned by Shin Bet. Your equipment will be confiscated and forensically examined. You may be charged under Israel's military security laws, which carry harsher penalties than civilian criminal trespass. And you'll be placed on a watch list that makes future entry into Israel difficult or impossible.
Your media organization gets flagged too. Future journalists from the same outlet will face additional scrutiny. The PBS documentary crew had pre-negotiated access, 14 days of pre-approved access with IRGC escorts, routes approved in advance, footage reviewed. That's not journalism in the sense of independent reporting. That's a managed experience.
This is the misconception we need to address directly. people see the PBS documentary and think, Iran let them in, so security must be lax. The reality is the opposite. The access was so tightly controlled that the crew never deviated from the approved itinerary. The documentary was a propaganda opportunity for Iran. They got to present their nuclear program on their terms, with their escorts, their talking points, their approved locations. The PBS crew didn't get access in the investigative sense. They got a guided tour.
The documentary aired March 25th of this year, and I watched it. It's well produced, it's informative, but you can see the edges of the frame. The camera never wanders. The questions are answered by pre-selected officials. The locations are clearly curated. This is the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It looks like journalism, but it's been arranged by the subject.
That's the real lesson here. Access is an illusion. Even the most impressive on-the-ground reporting from Iran is a managed experience. The question isn't whether you can get access, it's what happens when you step outside the managed script.
Which brings us to the practical question. If someone, a journalist, an OSINT researcher, a security analyst, actually wanted to approach a sensitive site, what should they know?
Let's get concrete. First, assume you're under surveillance from the moment you enter the country. Your phone is a tracking device. Leave it at the hotel. Use a burner with no SIM for navigation. Better yet, use a standalone GPS unit that doesn't transmit. But even then, your rental car is tagged, your face is in the system, and your hotel has reported your movements. You're not invisible.
Second, learn to read the escalation ladder. Passive monitoring means you're being watched, but not yet intercepted. Look for drones overhead, vehicles that appear at multiple points along your route, roadblocks that weren't there 10 minutes ago. Active tracking means someone is following you. Count the number of vehicles that seem to be maintaining a consistent distance. When you see spike strips or barriers appearing ahead, you're in interdiction territory.
Third, the most dangerous moment is the transition from phase 3 to phase 4, when the guards decide you're a threat rather than a nuisance. If you're boxed in, stop. Put your hands on the dashboard. Running triggers lethal response at both Isfahan and Dimona. The decision to shoot has already been delegated. You're not going to outrun it.
Fourth, do your homework before you travel. Use Google Earth historical imagery to map security perimeters. Check for recent tourist photos on Instagram that might reveal checkpoint locations. People geotag things constantly without thinking. OSINT tools like Sentinel Hub can show you recent satellite imagery with enough resolution to identify new construction or expanded perimeters.
There was a fascinating OSINT analysis in 2025 where analysts used Google Maps timestamps and Waze traffic data to estimate response times at the Negev facility. They found that a vehicle approaching from the east triggers a response in under 4 minutes, from the west in under 7. That's the kind of information you can gather without leaving your desk, and it tells you that approaching from the west buys you 3 extra minutes, which is not enough to matter, but is tactically interesting.
Under 4 minutes from the east. That's blisteringly fast. And that's the kind of detail that tells you this isn't a casual security arrangement. Someone has gamed out every approach vector and optimized the response.
Let's broaden the comparison for a moment, because Iran and Israel aren't the only countries with sensitive nuclear sites. North Korea's Yongbyon facility uses similar layered surveillance, but with more overt military presence. You're not going to get within 20 kilometers without encountering KPA checkpoints with armored vehicles. Pakistan's Khahuta facility is different. It relies more on tribal informants than electronic surveillance. The local population is co-opted into the security apparatus. You'll be reported by a shopkeeper before a camera ever sees you.
Which makes the Iran-Israel comparison unique. Both use a mix of high-tech and human intelligence, but in different ratios. Iran leans more on human senses. The Basij network, the IRGC's civilian informants, the mandatory reporting requirements for hotels and car rental agencies. Israel leans more on technology. Facial recognition, drone surveillance, automated turrets. But both achieve the same result. You're identified long before you're intercepted.
This has implications for intelligence agencies too. The drive-by reconnaissance technique is essentially obsolete. Satellite imagery and signals intelligence are far more effective and carry zero risk of diplomatic incident. But the human dimension still has value. Gauging guard reactions, measuring response times, observing whether a facility halts operations when an unexpected visitor approaches. The CII's 2024 assessment of Isfahan's defenses relied partly on analyzing social media posts from IRGC guards, not satellite photos, Instagram posts. Guards posting photos of their lunch with geotags that revealed patrol patterns.
That's the gig economy spy thing we've talked about before. Unwitting human intelligence. The guard doesn't know he's an intelligence asset. He's just posting his kebab.
And this is why Iran's security services are increasingly paranoid about social media. The IRGC has issued repeated directives prohibiting personnel from posting photos near sensitive sites, but enforcement is inconsistent. A bored 22-year-old conscript at a checkpoint outside Isfahan is going to post on Instagram. It's almost impossible to prevent.
Let's synthesize this into something actionable. If you're a journalist, an OSINT analyst, or just a curious person with a dangerous level of determination, here's what you need to internalize. The threat environment is not binary. It's a gradient with clear thresholds. Passive surveillance, active monitoring, verbal challenge, physical interdiction, lethal force. Each phase has observable indicators. Learn to recognize them.
Understand that getting close is rarely worth the risk. The information gain is marginal compared to what you can gather through satellite analysis, OSINT tools, and social media monitoring. The 2025 Waze traffic data analysis at Dimona produced more actionable intelligence than any drive-by ever could, and nobody got detained or shot.
If you're determined to try anyway, and I know some people are, the single most important thing you can do is recognize the transition from phase 3 to phase 4. When the boxing in happens, when the spike strips appear, when the armed personnel exit their vehicles, that's the moment. Stop, hands visible, no sudden movements. The guards are making a split-second threat assessment. Give them no reason to escalate.
Document everything before that moment. If you're in phase 2, being followed, being monitored, you're still in a window where you can observe and record. Note the drone activity. Note the number and type of vehicles. Note the response times. That observational data is valuable even if you never reach the site itself.
Let's talk about one more thing. The future of these security perimeters. Drone surveillance and facial recognition are getting cheaper and more widespread every year. Iran is already deploying loitering munitions as a permanent surveillance layer around sensitive sites. The Shahid 12-9 isn't just a reconnaissance platform, it's armed. What happens when every approach road is under 24/7 drone watch with automated threat detection?
The buffer zone expands. We're already seeing this. 5 years ago, the outer surveillance perimeter around Isfahan was probably 15 to 20 kilometers. Now, with persistent drone coverage, it's closer to 30 or 40. The drones can loiter for hours, they can track multiple vehicles simultaneously, and they can feed real-time video to a command center that's running facial recognition on the driver from altitude. You're identified before you even know there's a drone above you.
The line between journalist and intelligence asset is blurring to the point of invisibility. Iran and Israel both treat foreign journalists as potential spies by default. The PBS documentary may be one of the last of its kind. Future access will almost certainly require real-time GPS tracking of the crew, pre-approved routes with geofencing, and live monitoring of all footage by the host country's security services.
Which raises a philosophical question that I think is worth sitting with. If a documentary crew's every movement is tracked, their footage reviewed, their questions pre-screened, and their locations curated, is that journalism? Or is it a co-production with the security state?
It's a co-production. But it might be the only kind of on-the-ground reporting we get from places like Isfahan going forward. The era of the independent journalist driving toward a sensitive site with a camera and a notebook is over. It's been over for a while. The PBS documentary just made it look like it wasn't.
That's the uncomfortable truth at the bottom of this thought experiment. The access was managed, the documentary was shaped, and if you tried to replicate it without the pre-negotiated permissions, you'd be detained, expelled, or worse. The security architecture we've described is not hypothetical. It's operational, it's tested, and it works.
To wrap this up, the prompt asked what would happen if you drove toward Isfahan or Dimona. The answer is, you'd be watched from the moment you entered the country. actively tracked from 20 kilometers out, interdicted at 5, and shot at inside one. The only variable is whether you'd be captured first. And the deeper insight is that even the journalists who seem to have access are operating inside a tightly managed script. Step outside it, and the system reveals itself.
The open question we should leave listeners with, as drone surveillance and facial recognition become ubiquitous, will the buffer zone around sensitive sites expand to the point where no unauthorized approach is possible at all? We're already seeing Iran deploy loitering munitions as a permanent surveillance layer. Give it 5 years, and the outer perimeter might be 50 kilometers. At that distance, getting close means looking at satellite imagery on your laptop, which is probably what you should have been doing in the first place.
Which is a sobering thought, but also a practical one. The tools for remote observation are better than they've ever been. The tools for on-the-ground access are more constrained than they've ever been. Adjust your expectations accordingly. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a British colonial administrator in the Solomon Islands documented a pigment trading network so elaborate that certain shades of red ochre were valued by weight against gold, not for artistic use, but because the specific iron oxide composition from one volcanic deposit was believed, under Tang Dynasty bureaucratic color-coding principles that had somehow filtered across the Pacific through trade routes, to confer legal authority on the chief who wore it during land disputes.
Hey, right?
That's going to sit with me for a while. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. It genuinely helps other listeners find the show. We're at myweirdprompts.com for past episodes, show notes, and the full archive. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.